We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover this week, starting with local or regional, I guess, and developments in Olympia.
Yeah, this week the state legislators are saying that they are going to have a budget by late Sunday night, hopefully early next week, in order to avoid a government shutdown. In the meantime, I don't know how many people actually believe that, but in the meantime, state agencies have released their contingency plans in case of a government shutdown, and it's not looking good. For example, state parks would close down, and all events and camping that that people have plans to do this summer in any state park would have to be canceled. State prisons would still house and feed current prisoners, but they wouldn't be able to take any new ones. In other words, any transfers from county jails would have to stay there. So local jails would fill up really
quickly.
And
the Department of Corrections would lay off about 3,000 of their 8,000 employees, too. Basically, with the DOC, they have federal law mandates to keep some of their services going.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, so they're conflicted by that. And that's true of several agencies in state government where they legally, they can't shut down.
And so
what do you do when there's no money?
Yeah, and so, for example, the Department of Corrections, they have to house and feed their current prison population, so they're going to keep people on staff to do that, but they're not going to keep parole officers going. So there's about 15,000 prisoners who are on work release and parole and community release. Those guys would not be supervised anymore. Looking at DSHS, the Department of Social and Health Services, a lot of their programs would be affected.
Child care subsidies, mm-hmm. food and nutrition programs.
Alcohol and substance abuse programs, community mental health programs would close. Senior services and disability programs would have to be suspended. Even programs for workforce training would have to be closed. So this is what we're risking when you have the state legislature taking this long to pass a budget.
All in all, you're looking at 34 state agencies that would shut down completely, including the governor's office and the auditor's office and the state lottery. 24 agencies would shut down partially. That includes the Department of Ecology, Employment Security, Fish and Wildlife, the Health Department, Department of Corrections,
so
as
no,
we mentioned.
No inspections of restaurants, for example.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there would be only 25 state agencies would remain open, all told. And colleges and universities and departments that don't rely on the operating budget for their money primarily, and then the essential services that we kind of things we talked about. But a lot of this is shut down. And again, it's exactly the same dynamic that's leading to budget impasses at the federal level. It's because you have a major party that is really to a level unprecedented in American history, ideologically committed to not compromising and not negotiating on essential legislation in a governmental system that requires compromising and negotiating in order to reach agreement.
And what underlies their much of their platform is this notion that less government is better, which means shutting down state agencies and not providing services that not only have we all come to take for granted, but that we all pretty much need in order to live in a civilized society. Those services the Republicans would like to just do away with.
Including services that prevent a lot of people from dying.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, news this week from the Army Corps of Engineers.
Yeah, the Army Corps of Engineers announcing this week in a report to Congress that it will not take climate change into account in their environmental review when deciding whether to approve the enormous proposed Gateway Pacific Terminal up at Cherry Point or two other proposed enormous coal terminals in the Pacific Northwest. They are saying that they want instead to strictly consider, you know, the environmental impacts of the proposed projects, as though climate change has nothing to do with the environment. So basically you have a dynamic where the terminals will help climate change become a lot worse than if they're not built, but that's really not relevant so long as the terminals don't impinge on neighboring wetlands or something like that. The rationale is that it's outside their mandate to consider indirect, is the word they used, consequences like that. But really, that's the only point in the process at which those consequences can be considered. So it is very much a punting by the Obama administration on looking at that. And it's very much the same dynamic as is likely to go into the decision, which is widely expected to approve, that the State Department is going to announce sometime in the next few weeks around the Keystone XL pipeline. And as with the coal trains and the building of these terminals, the pressure has really got to come from the company's ability to finance these projects and from direct action, because it's not going to come from the Obama administration.
All right. Moving on, the state of our state bridges.
Yeah, the Washington State Department of Transportation, it turns out from evidence found by the Associated Press this week, has been conducting very inconsistent oversight of the state's bridges. Now, the state DOT is supposed to be in charge of maintaining the state's bridges, and if one needs repairs, scheduling repairs, and if one is unstable or requires limits in terms of what weight of vehicle or size of vehicle can cross the bridge, then the state DOT is supposed to be consistently issuing cautions for that bridge whenever it issues an oversized load permit to a trucking company. Now, it turns out that the DOT has several bridges that it consistently issues cautions for, but the bridge over the Skagit River, the I-5 bridge over the Skagit River that fell here a little over a month ago, that bridge was never on that list, and they never issued a caution for that bridge, even though they've been looking at damage to the bridge since the 1970s from trucks hitting it. And just recently, in the last couple of years, they'd noticed some very significant damage to some key support beams on the bridge. And that bridge is also fracture critical, which means that one good hit by a single oversized load could take on the right support structure could take the whole, or did in this case, take the whole bridge down. So I think we need to be asking who at the state DOT is responsible for this program of issuing cautions for bridges, and why wasn't the Skagit River Bridge on that list? And who's going to be responsible for taking the blame for this? And whether there, and you know, we should be asking too, are there any other bridges out there that are in the same shape that the DOT isn't paying any attention to and isn't issuing cautions for?
All right. Moving on, update this week on Nicholsville.
We had reporting this week that the city issued edict from Mayor Mike McGinn at behest of City Council to close Nicholsville on September 1st. Came in part due to pressure from the federal government and the Obama administration, the Department of Health and Human Services, telling the city they've been trying in different cities around the country to crack down on tent cities. And the word to the city is, we will pull funding if you allow any kind of permanent status for Nicholsville. Now, why exactly it's the business of the federal government to interfere in what a local government decides around how to deal with its homeless population is a good question. But this is a trend that we've been seeing from the federal government particularly, but also state and local governments in the last recent years, that, you know, we don't want to provide services for the homeless. We don't want to fund shelters. We don't want to allow tent cities because we want to get people into housing. Well, yes, we do want to get people into housing. But that's not going to happen overnight. And at the same time, you know, people need to be able to go somewhere and they need to be able to be safe when they do so. And there aren't nearly the shelter beds in a place like King County to accommodate the homeless population. Something like 9 out of 10 people who are homeless do not sleep in shelters on any given night in King County.
And if you're going to have the attitude that, you know, we don't want to support homeless services because we want people to live in housing, you better have better housing policies. The federal government, the state government, and the city government have all punted on issues concerning helping homeowners going through foreclosure, helping people who are going through bankruptcies and are at risk of losing their homes, and also making sure that affordable housing is constructed in areas where people can have access to the services that they need in order to get off the street and get into housing. That's not been happening. And if you're going to have this, you have to do one or the other. You have to either fund services for the homeless and help homeless people find a place to stay, even if it's not permanent housing, or you have to get serious about affordable housing, and neither of those two things are happening.
Yeah. As we've talked about with the city of Seattle repeatedly on this show, we've had policies for a number of years now that have not built, but have actually destroyed affordable housing
exactly.
in the city, and prioritized instead market rate housing. So, you know, telling a family of four that we don't want you living in your car or living in a shelter or living in some place like Nicholsville, we want you instead to move into the housing that we're created, doesn't really help when the housing is, you know, $2,000 a month studio apartments in Belltown.
Yeah.
Or South Lake Union.
All right. Moving on, Congress this week voting on an abortion ban.
Yeah, we talked last week about this, a House bill that would ban all abortions, including those involving rape or incest. Remember only 3 or 4 years ago when you had the odd Republican anti-abortion activist advocating no exceptions for rape and incest? That was considered hugely controversial. It's now the mainstream position for the entire Republican Party, almost all of which at the congressional level voted for this bill in the House that would ban all abortions after 20 weeks. That's a little over 4 months.
Although they were persuaded at the end to include, finally persuaded at the end to include exceptions for rape and incest.
Yeah, they were, but I mean that wasn't how
it
was pitched.
But that was not how it was originally pitched, and they were hoping to pass it without those.
Yeah. The bill had the title the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. And you know, the only problems with that, of course, are that fetuses are not only not unborn children, they're also not pain capable. This is sort of the latest anti-abortion talking point that we want to prevent fetuses from feeling pain. They never talk about the pain of the mother, of course, but you had the entire Washington State Republican delegation voting in favor of this radical bill, including Dave Reichert, who has made a career out of presenting himself as moderate and reasonable, voting in favor of a pretty radical Tea Party-ish bill in this case. But the problem with the pain-capable unborn child protection aid is that fetuses don't feel pain at 20 weeks. Actual scientists know better. You had a report, for example, from the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which is a UK organization, so it's mercifully free of you know, evangelical Christians that dominate U.S. politics. A 2010 report on the topic, and I'm going to quote it a little bit because, again, you're starting to hear this meme a lot, and it's not being challenged in corporate media reports. Quote, in reviewing the neuroanatomical and physiological evidence in the fetus, it was apparent that connections from the periphery to the cortex are not intact before 24 weeks of gestation, and as most neuroscientists believe that the cortex is necessary for pain perception, it can be concluded that the fetus cannot experience pain in any sense prior to this gestation. After 24 weeks, there is continuing development and elaboration of intracortical networks such that noxious stimuli in newborn preterm infants produce cortical responses. Such connections to the cortex are necessary for pain experience but not sufficient, as evidence of external stimuli requires consciousness. Furthermore, there's increasing evidence that the fetus never experiences a state of true wakefulness in utero and is kept by the presence of its chemical environment in a continuous sleep-like unconscious or sedation state. This state can suppress higher cortical activation in the presence of intrusive external stimuli. This observation highlights the important differences between fetal and neonatal life and the difficulties of extrapolating from observations made in newborn preterm infants to the fetus. In other words, the short version of that, it's physiologically impossible for 20-week-old fetuses to feel pain. It's at least another month, probably more, before the brain is developed enough. It may well be that no fetus experiences pain because they're simply not awake, and that fetuses are not physically the same thing as infants hiding in mom's belly.
Yes,
all of those things are fallacies.
There's a biological reason for that, and because if that were not the case, women would not be able to bear children inside their bodies.
Yeah.
You know, think about it. You don't want an awake, screaming, squirming infant inside your body if you're a man or a woman. Okay.
I'm flashing to scenes from Alien.
Yeah, I did too.
Exactly. Okay. You know, I mean, this is the kind of thing that Republican men don't bother to stop and think about.
Yeah. The very phrase unborn child is an oxymoron. If it's unborn, it's not a child.
Mm-hmm.
It has the potential to become one, but it is not one.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that you can have these kind of extreme fallacies really repeated and popularized in mainstream media without any questioning is really pretty appalling.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on. Supreme Court ruling this week.
Yeah, the Supreme Court ruled this week on a 5-3 decision that the Federal Trade Commission can sue pharmaceutical companies for antitrust violations. And why, you may ask, is this important? Well, the case is, in this case, the FTC versus Actavis deals with a pharmaceutical company paying a competitor not to make a generic version of one of their drugs. These are called pay-for-delay deals. And they have long, critics high healthcare spending have long cited them as one of the things that drives up the price of drugs. For example, prescription drugs in the U.S. accounted for $320 billion in U.S. healthcare spending in the year 2011. $320 billion on prescription medicine. That's, you know, a good chunk of the federal deficit there, right?
Yeah, you could invade another country for that.
You certainly could. Brand name drugs were only 18% of the total prescriptions written by doctors in the year 2011, but they accounted for 73% of all the money spent on prescription medicines that year. So these pay-for-delay deals are clearly one element of why healthcare costs are so high, particularly the costs of prescription medicines. Justice Anthony Kennedy joined the liberal group of the Supreme Court, which included Justices Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg in voting for this ruling to allow the Federal Trade Commission to sue pharmaceutical companies to nullify many of these pay-for-delay deals. So I think that's very good news.
All right. Also this week, a study out on Gulf War illness.
Yeah, a very small but I think very important study on Gulf War illness by Georgetown University was released and published in PLOS-1, the online journal. It was a study of veterans of the first Gulf War back in 1991. Think back to 1991, folks. And they found that those vets who suffer from Gulf War illness do have real biological damage in their brains. They have those areas of their brains that deal with heart rate, perception of pain, and short-term memory. Now, about 250,000 soldiers, that's about a good quarter of a million of them who served in the Gulf in 1990 to 91, have reported symptoms of Gulf War illness. The study, of course, didn't look at the actual potential cause of Gulf War illness. It was just looking for a biological basis for it. And it's good news for a lot of these soldiers who've been told over the years that, no, it's all in your head. No, it's all just stress. No, it's all, you know, combat stress or PTSD or whatever.
And as it turns out, if there is brain damage, it is, in fact, in their head.
Well, yes, it is. But it is real biological damage. Some of the potential causes, which it would be nice if someone would do a study and look at that.
Funded by OSA, the federal government.
Yeah, would include exposure to nerve agents when weapons dumps were destroyed, potentially exposure to pesticides, herbicides, other chemicals, vaccines. Many were vaccinated heavily before they went over to the Gulf, and exposure to burning oil wells.
And depleted uranium.
Yes, and potentially depleted uranium. Too.
All right. No fault of their own.
Report by the New York Times in the wake of the shooting of an associate of the Boston Marathon bombers in Florida by an FBI agent. The New York Times came out with a report this week that the FBI has found itself faultless, that's their term, in all 150 incidents over the last 20 or so years in which agents discharged their guns and killed or wounded someone. The FBI allows use of deadly force only if agents fear that their lives or fellow agents are in danger, and it doesn't happen all that often, contrary to what you might think by watching TV shows or Hollywood movies. You know, most law enforcement at any level doesn't really discharge their guns very often. It's pretty rare. But when they do, as with King County, where over the last 30 years that we've had the system, no inquest yet has found an officer to be at fault when somebody is killed from a law enforcement firearm. Same thing with the FBI. They investigate themselves, and in their investigation of themselves, even in the case in Maryland a few years ago, where they paid out a $1.3 million settlement to the family of somebody who was killed by an agent, but the internal investigation did not discipline the agent and did not find the agent at fault. This, again, is an argument for law enforcement at all levels being accountable to civilian oversight, because law enforcement the odds that every single shooting was justified and that nothing was done wrong in any of those cases are astronomical just by human nature. Not calling the training or intention of the law enforcement officers or the FBI agents in this case into question. It's just a matter of human nature that stuff happens. So you've clearly got a dynamic within law enforcement where they can't hold themselves accountable. That is why you have to have civilian oversight.
All right. Well, speaking of civilian oversight, military judge making a ruling this week.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. Military judge this week, Navy judge Commander Marcus Fulton, ruling in the case of a defendant who had been convicted of sexual abuse in the military that he could not be dishonorably discharged because in a press conference in May, President Obama said the following in response to the Pentagon's report at that time talking about epidemic levels of sexual assault and sexual abuse and sexual harassment in the military. Obama said, quote, "I expect consequences. I don't just want more speeches or awareness programs or trainings, but ultimately folks look the other way. If we find out somebody's engaging in this, they've got to be held accountable. Prosecuted, stripped of their positions, court-martialed, fired, dishonorably discharged, period." What the judge ruled is that because Obama at the commander-in-chief said this and recommended, even though it wasn't tied to a specific case, that people be held accountable for raping or sexually assaulting somebody, that therefore it's the actual phrase is unlawful command influence, that it would cause a commander to think that he can't rule otherwise because they'll incur the wrath of the commander-in-chief. And therefore, defendants in such cases can't be held accountable, which is seriously funhouse thinking. It's sort of like saying, well, if somebody said that people who rob banks should be sent to prison for it, therefore we can't send somebody to prison for robbing a bank. It's that kind of logic.
It tells you how messed up the military justice system is.
It tells you how messed up the military justice system is, and it tells you just how contorted in their reasoning the military hierarchy will go in order to justify, apologize, and enable people who commit sexually motivated crimes.
All right. Moving on, further revelations this week from The Guardian in
the
UK.
The Guardian posted another article by Glenn Greenwald about the secret rules that allow the NSA to use email data of U.S. citizens. This is referring to the PRISM program that the NSA administers, where they're able to gather and look at any email or internet communications by who they determine to be foreign actors who might be a threat to the United States, but also U.S. citizens who communicate with people living abroad, or U.S. citizens who are living abroad, who they think may be a terrorism threat. Two documents were posted by The Guardian. These documents were originally submitted to the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Court. These two documents detail the procedures that the NSA is supposed to follow. What's clear right off the bat when you read them is that, yes, someone is reading your email. I mean, that's very clear, because there's really no other way that they can tell whether or not your communications contain information that relates to U.S. security and or terrorism. Somebody has to at least scan them for keywords and key phrases. Okay, so that's number one when you look at these. Number two is if they're not sure if they can't tell whether or not you're a U.S. citizen, then they can automatically treat you as if you were a foreign citizen. So if they can't immediately see right away whether you're a U.S. citizen living in the United States at the time, then they're free to just read whatever. The FISA court orders that allow the NSA to get access to internet records in the first place, those court orders don't really function like a subpoena or a regular criminal court order. They don't specify any individuals' names. They don't specify any details about why they need the court order or the warrant in order to track a particular person or a particular group. They're just blanket orders that allow the NSA to go in and grab bulk data, just take everything at an internet service provider or a media company. And also, then supposedly, for NSA analysts to look at the emails and the information and the online tracking of an individual person or of a group of people, they're supposed to get an individual warrant issued by the FISA court. But these individual warrants are single paragraph, they're sheets of paper with a single paragraph on them that, again, don't contain any data about the person or the group targeted. They're just a rubber stamp, basically.
Or why they might need to be investigated.
Yeah, that lets the NSA analysts decide who to target and why for surveillance. So you can imagine that the NSA has boxes of these things sitting around.
Warehouses.
You know? Yeah, exactly. And when they need to, and when they think they need to look at a particular person's email or a particular group of people, they just grab a piece of paper out of a box, stick it in a file folder, and they're done. You know, in terms of this court. This court is not really, it's pretty clear, this court is not really functioning like a typical criminal court does. It's just a rubber stamp, essentially, that allows the NSA analysts entire discretion over who they look at and why.
And a couple other things about this. One is that one of Obama's defenses against this in interviews this week has been, well, it's a transparent process because people have to through reviews before the FISA court. Well, even if the FISA court were functional, which is, as Maria just talked about, it isn't. FISA court itself is not transparent, so it's still not a transparent process. The other thing that came out this week is that the NSA is combining this in terms of the files that it compiles on individual people with facial recognition software, mm-hmm. so that it's actually taking photographs of different people and integrating it with facial recognition software with all of these files, so that as part of our surveillance state, you see somebody come up on a monitor, or your surveillance of somebody, or a satellite shot, and from the facial recognition can call up all of this information on what they've gotten from your phone records and your email and such. It's very Orwellian.
All right, that leaves you not really
enough. How much time do we have left?
Well, about 30 seconds if you want to do international, which is not enough. Who can do that in 30 seconds? All right, then. Let's move on then to events.
Yeah, a couple of events. One starting in just an hour or so, a living wage forum being sponsored by the Church Council of Greater Seattle. That'll be at the Plymouth Congregational Church, 6th and University in downtown Seattle. Also in downtown, by the way, at 9:30, mayoral candidates are having a forum in the Bertha Landis room at City Hall on public safety with the Seattle Police Officers Guild and such. That might be interesting to check out. Then this coming Friday, June 28th at 7 o'clock, Syria, a nation and region in crisis, forum that'll be held with Rita Zawada, I can never pronounce her name, sorry. Sorry, Rita. And then Richard Silverstein, who is on the show at 7:30 and who is really an excellent, excellent Middle East blogger. That'll be held, that forum on Syria will be held at University Temple United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in Seattle's U District, this coming Friday at 7 p.m.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.